The Spotlight.
It was one of the deadliest operations of the Israeli regime forces in years. Some have called it a massacre. At least 10 Palestinians killed, more than 100 injured in a raid in Nablus. Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank have become more frequent, especially since this far-right cabinet has come to power. Is this due to the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, whose previous times in power have been marred by violence and Palestinian deaths? Or is this part of what has been called the continual, systematic ethnic cleansing of Palestinians? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Bukhaber Abusada is a lecturer at Al-Azhar University at Gaza City. Joe Catron also joins us. He's the U.S. coordinator at Sami Doun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Bukhaber Abusada, I'll start with you. Taking a look at what has happened in Nablus, it has been now categorized as really a massacre in terms of the raid itself, where 10 so far have been reported to have been killed, and you have over 100 injured, and based on the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, which you're probably aware of this particular part of the report on the number of injured, where it's over 100, and many of them have suffered more than one gunshot wound. What does that tell you about this raid, first of all? I guess first I want to get your reaction on what has happened.
According to Israeli sources, is that Israel went into the old city of Nablus to try to arrest some Palestinian activists who belong to the Nablus Brigade, who are fighting the Israeli occupation and fighting Israeli settlers. And according to Palestinian sources, that Israeli security and Israeli military men were disguised in a civilian uniform, trying to infiltrate the old city of Nablus, where they tried to arrest those Palestinian activists. And they surrounded the Palestinian home where those Palestinian activists were being. And they started bombing the house with anti-tank missiles and firing live ammunition at the Palestinians who were hiding in that old city house in Nablus. At the end of the day, as you just reported, more than 10 Palestinians were killed, including two elderly Palestinians. One is 72 and another person is 61. In addition to that, two Palestinian teenagers were also killed in this Israeli operation. More than 100 Palestinians were injured. About seven of them have been injured with serious wounds that some of them might not even make it because of the live ammunition that was used by Israeli armed forces. And as a result of that, what we have seen today in the city of Nablus is a Palestinian uprising, a Palestinian intifada, or a former Palestinian intifada against the Israeli infiltrating forces in the old city of Nablus.
Okay.
The way we can describe it, this is an appalling Israeli massacre, or a new Israeli massacre against the Palestinians. Since the beginning of this year, more than 60 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli military occupation forces, and hundreds also have been injured. And unfortunately, this comes after a deal lately at the UN Security Council, where the Palestinians withdrew a decision on which was presented by the Security Council in exchange for a de-escalation by the Israeli armed forces. But what we have seen today is that Israel has basically betrayed its own pledges to the UN Security Council and to
sure.
the international community to de-escalate its aggression against the Palestinian people.
Joe Catron, what we need to break down here with you, because I think it's very necessary to do this, and that is the fact that we're looking at what Israel calls suspected militants, okay? When we take a look at that term as the reason for the raid to have occurred, the Israeli army has proceeded with that intention to seek out ones or Palestinians who it seems or deems to be, in their eyes, suspected militants. So let's draw out the scenario. You're an Israeli security force member. You're inside your armored vehicle, and you go into Nablus. How do you differentiate, first of all, who is against you and who's not, when presumably everybody that's out there on the street is against the Israeli forces? And this is not the first time that this has happened. So that's one side of the coin. And then the other is the term suspected militants. How do you go and you kill people who you think may have either committed a crime against Israel or settlers or what have you, or may do so in the future, when they haven't committed the crime in the first place?
Well, I think in both cases, you're talking about longstanding patterns of Israeli behavior. We know that Israel ultimately makes very little effort to distinguish. In the process of killing one target, they will think very little of killing a dozen other people along with them, because they happen to be in the same place or in the same building. This is something we've seen repeatedly in the Gaza Strip, even more than in the West Bank. Additionally, they use targeted assassinations. They simply do not hesitate to kill anyone they see as a fighter with impunity, with no trial, no legal process, no real evidence. Although in many cases, we should be clear, these are actual fighters, some of them, who have taken up arms in resistance to the occupation, as they're absolutely entitled to do. The numbers I saw going around just before I jumped on this call were that 2 of the 10 Palestinians killed in Nablus this morning had been, in fact, resistance fighters, while the others were civilians. If we want, that's not the best used word to use. Of course, there's a sense in which they're all civilians. But we are dealing with an actual resistance, which Israel is doing everything in its power to suppress. For various complicated reasons, parts of the West Bank in Jenin and Nablus and elsewhere are simply spinning out of its control, as well as out of the control of the Palestinian Authority, which we often see reinforcing Israel's attempts to rule. And they're doing everything they're capable of to suppress this new resistance, which we haven't really seen in the West Bank on this scale since the Second Intifada 2 decades ago. And of course, they're willing to commit any atrocity to accomplish their aims.
Sure. Mohammed Abu Sada, we are looking at the death toll that happened today to equal what happened recently at the Jenin refugee camp, which was a raid that happened last month with the same intentions, with the same motives. And that was deemed at that point one of the deadliest operations since the year 2005. Now, why are we looking at these raids to turn this deadly? Maybe we can stomach the fact that Israel continues with targeting Palestinians, but, you know, the raid last month, then what happened today, and again, what pointing to a deadlier future for Palestinians. Is it because of this far-right Israeli cabinet that has come into power, headed by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
That is a very good question. But let me say that Israeli massacres against the Palestinian people did not just start with the coming of this new right, extreme right-wing government led by Netanyahu, which came at the end of the year 2022. Israeli massacres have been going on against the Palestinian people for more than 75 years, starting from the Nakba in 1948, where Israel expelled more than two-thirds of the Palestinian people from their own homes, from their own villages and their own towns into the neighboring Arab countries. And over the past 75 years, more than 50 Israeli massacres have been done against the Palestinian people from, as I mentioned, from Deir Yassin in 1948 all the way until now. Now, it's also true that what happened today in the city of Nablus very much resembles what happened in the city of Jenin just a month ago, where about 10 Palestinians were also killed by the Israeli occupation forces. Israel is all the time trying to justify what they are doing, that they are going after Palestinian activists who, in legally speaking, are fighting the Israeli occupation and apartheid regime that exists on the Palestinian occupied territory. Let me also say one more thing, that the year of 2022, where it was a different Israeli government, a government by the left and center left, more than 170 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank, and around 50 Palestinians were killed in the Gaza Strip. Overall, more than 220 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli armed forces in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza in the year 22, which was more than any other year since the year of 2005. So it's not only the current Israeli government or the right-wing Israeli government led by Netanyahu who is engaging in massacres and killing and extrajudicial killing against the Palestinians. All Israeli government, left, right, center, whatever you call it, they have been committed massacres and committed aggression against the Palestinian people for many years. And unfortunately, this new massacre that happened today in Nablus just comes after a week where the UN Security Council was debating a Security Council resolution to condemn Israeli settlement expansion or condemn Israeli legalization of illegal outposts in the West Bank. What we are seeing is, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many international organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and even the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, they all have basically categorized Israel as an occupation and an apartheid regime against the Palestinian people, which commits massacres and aggression against the Palestinian people without international protection. Sure. And that's why it's the responsibility of the UN, it's the responsibility of the international community to provide protection for the Palestinian civilian population from these Israeli atrocities.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, Joe Catron, I don't know if you agree. We could talk about what our guest there said regarding the UN, where it didn't issue a resolution against Israel, but rather went down for a watered-down, statement condemning Israel for its planned settlement expansion. But when you talk about an organization like the UN, when it comes to Palestinians and the way that Israel has violated or not listen to all these resolutions that has been issued against it, we can see that there is no regard for the UN, and in turn, the UN has not really done much for Palestinians. So I'm going to put that conversation to the side and ask you about the most recent visit of the U.S., Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, visiting the occupied territories he was there to try to calm the situation down. But we're seeing, since he left, that actually the violence has increased somewhat. And then we're looking at what has happened today. So what do you make of that, the fact that that visit did not smooth things out? And in particular, when you have such far-right extremist members like Itamar Gavir, who basically has said that anybody rejecting Israel should be deemed a terrorist and in turn then executed.
Well, I think that Blinken's visit and his declared goals were unlikely to achieve much in the aftermath of a new Israeli government. Remember, Israeli political parties and governing coalitions compete with each other on the basis of their brutality against Palestinians. Each wants to accomplish at least as many atrocities as the last government, because that's how much of the Israeli public evaluates them. At the same time, we all know, regrettably, that the United States is unconditional in its support for Israel and its crimes. Our president, Joe Biden, has said multiple times that if there were no Israel, the United States would have to invent one to advance its interests in the region. So these U.S. attempts have to be seen in the context of the U.S. ultimately trying to advance its shared goals with Israel, perhaps through slightly different strategies. They might prefer that we didn't see these repeated atrocities making it onto the front pages of the newspaper quite as much. But at the end of the day, they're on the same page. They're trying to achieve the same things, particularly in the region, more so than in Palestine. They share common enemies, and the United States sees Israel as a very useful asset in the area to achieve its own goals. And that's why the United States is also ironclad in its support for Israel in the United Nations, not only blocking movement in the Security Council, as we've seen more times than I would care to count, but also using its funding of UN agencies, which is oversized, along with the funding from other Western powers, which are favorable to Israel, and its influence on various member states to prevent any real action against Israeli atrocities.
Let's take a look at Mukhabar Abbasada, the group that has been mentioned to have its birthplace in Nablus, and that is a group by the name of the Lion's Den, which is amongst a number of groups that are basically homegrown Palestinians who have formed these groups in order to obviously stand up against Israel. We know that this happened after, in March of 2022, based on what we have, where you had 19 Palestinians, you had a number of Palestinians forming this group because of the raids that happened in Nablus. And they're not affiliated to any of the common resistance groups that are out there, based at least on the records that we have. Are we looking at this being a real threat for Israel, which is why they've been targeted, for example, not only in Jenin, but in Nablus?
What we see in the Palestinian occupied territories is a new phenomena where a group of young Palestinians who have grown sick of the Israeli occupation, who have grown sick of Israeli aggression and Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people, and also a lack of protection from the international community, as we just spoke, and also the inability of the Palestinian Authority to provide security for its own people, who is coordinating on the security level with the Israeli occupation forces. All of these reasons have pushed a number of Palestinian youth, where in the city of Nablus, where they have established the Lion's Den, or in the city of Jenin, where they have established the Jenin Brigade. And basically, these brigades, whether the Jenin Brigade or the Lion Dens, they are Palestinian youth between the age of 18 and 23 who are dedicated to fighting the Israeli occupation, who are dedicated to fighting Israeli settler violence in the Palestinian occupied West Bank. And what we have been witnessing lately is Israel continue to raid these cities, whether the city of Jenin or the city of Nablus, to try to finish or to try to put an end to this new phenomena that is growing in the Palestinian occupied territories, which also they are trying to fill the vacuum where the Palestinian resistance groups like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian groups have been, to some extent, have been deterred by the Israeli attacks against them, whether in Gaza or the West Bank, to carry out attacks against Israel. So we have seen a number of Palestinian youth who are organized in the Lion's Den or the Jenin Brigade, who are fighting the Israeli occupation. And also, we have seen a new phenomenon lately in the Palestinian territories, which is described by Israel as the lone wolf operation, where individual Palestinians take things onto their own hands by going after Israeli army post or Israeli settlers to try to defend themselves and defend their villages from Israeli settler attacks. So what we, in general, what I can tell you is that as a result of the Israeli continued aggression, as a result of the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people, which have been going on for 75 years now, mm-hmm. the Palestinians have decided that they have to defend themselves. They have to fight back. Sure. They have to protect their own people, and they have to protect their own land from this Israeli aggression. And this is what we are basically seeing in different areas of the West Bank, whether Jenin, Nablus, and sometimes we also see the same model in the city of Hebron or the city of Beit Lahem also.
Okay. Well, since we're quickly running out of time here, Joe Catron, tell us the different dynamics that are involved here whether this is going to lead to something that is it should be a threat to Israel. You're looking at the one hand, what we just discussed with our other guests in Gaza City, about these groups that are homegrown, forming themselves, that don't have any real affiliation to the common resistance groups. That's on the one hand. Then you have the resistance groups that are well known, like the Islamic Jihad, like Hamas. On the other hand, you have Israel that's dealing with a domestic crisis. You have Israelis that have come out in full force for over 2 months against Netanyahu and his extremist cabinet. And then you have another factor, like Israelis migrating out of Israel, and some that's been speeded up because of the fact that they want to show in protest that they're against this this cabinet. Are we looking at all these different factors contributing to be a real threat for Israel, given the fact that there's this notion out there that after 80 years, Israel will cease to exist?
I certainly think we're looking at some very real threats for Israel. The regime itself obviously sees the renewed resistance in the West Bank as a viable threat, which is why it's been responding with such ferocity. It's also contributing, in a way, I think, to Israel's internal crisis, which you mentioned, the fact that they can't seem to keep a government in office for more than a year, and there's essentially no political consensus to be found among Israelis, except in brutality against Palestinians. That's their one common denominator, and it's the reason why successive Israeli governments make it such a point to commit brutality, because they know this is the one thing that will bring different political forces together, while in the absence of a common enemy, we would probably be instead discussing an Israeli civil war.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you. Joe Catron, U.S. Coordinator, Sami Doun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Mukhabir Abu Sada, lecturer at the Al-Azhar University from Gaza City. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
Faqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
امام صادق فرمودن دو گروه کمر منو شکستن قطع از زهری اسنان.
In a narration by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, we read, two groups of people broke my back, the implied scholar and the ignorant worshipper. Being a scholar does not bring a person politeness, and the religious gown and garment do not bring a spiritual perfection. If we want to serve Allah and Imam al-Mahdi Jalallah, we must be serious in our works and try hard on this path.
بخوای آدم ای که بگن خواستن بگی روایت شمینه من جد و جد.
As the famous proverb says, where there is a wish, there is a way. We can't be nurtured by Imam al-Mahdi if we are not serious in our life. There must be a desire in our heart to move us forward. This motivation must be in line with that of Allah and His Ahlul Bayt. Without serious practice and belief, we can't reach salvation in this world and the hereafter. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
یوسف جلالی تهران
روباشاوید گازا
جروم هیوز بروسلز
سعید پورزا لندن
راشان سگلم استانبول
سعید امین عالمی کابل
شهان باد اندین ادمنستر کشمیر
Around the world with reporters.
Bringing currency volatility under control is the name of the game for the new governor of the Central Bank of Iran, Mohammad Reza Farzin, who is charged with getting a grip on the Iranian rial and devising new strategies to alleviate the country's economic woes amid unprecedented Western sanctions. And to do so, he has unveiled a new golden currency exchange center in an effort to regulate market fluctuations, or in his own words, stabilize market rates by adjusting demand and supply. But most importantly, as a powerful tool to control speculative inflation. For those familiar with Iran's economy, the most essential economic parameter that can effectively tip the scales.
We have enough resources to provide for all demands for exchange. The main challenge we are facing is speculative inflation as a consequence of negative forecasts, which leads to producers increasing the price of commodities and therefore creates a vicious circle. We need to overcome this challenge, and I'm calling on all those involved in economic activities to join hands with us and strictly follow the new policies of this newly launched center of exchange.
This means that all foreign exchange resources, notably from export, must be supervised by the central bank.
The 28,500 toman exchange rate for basic commodities and essential medicines still stands. Other demands for foreign currencies have been carefully categorized, and in the first leg, we are allocating $4 million to specific purposes, which include travel, studying abroad, and research projects, the details of which will be announced shortly.
This is actually a policy that has been successfully implemented by Russia and allowed the ruble to recover its value within a month after its initial plunge at the beginning of the Ukraine war.
Russia's success in implementing this policy is mostly due to their system of financial supervision, which ensures that regulatory rules are strictly observed. There are major differences between the economic and monetary structures and approaches of Iran and Russia. And if Iran wants to succeed, it has to take all this into account.
And the good news is, if this policy is successfully implemented, the recovery of the rial is imminent in a situation very similar to what happened in Russia.
Russia's national currency is gaining strength. The ruble is hitting new highs against the U.S. dollar. The Russian economy is making a turnaround despite unprecedented Western sanctions and pressure. Now Iran, taking Russia as a role model, is hoping to do the same. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
They said they were in it for the long haul, and they have kept their promise. Thousands of ambulance drivers from two separate unions walking off the job across much of England and Wales. Their demand, a pay award that keeps pace with the rising cost of living. The message, that the service is already stretched beyond its limit. Mondays are typically the busiest day for ambulance services across the country, with people now advised to use the 991 service only in an emergency. Despite the disruption, public support for the strikers is strong.
I live with two ambulance drivers and a nurse, so my answer is yes, they deserve more. I think they need more pay, yes.
We're very lucky the people that are working in the hospitals are nice enough to carry on working during the pandemic and not strike earlier, to be fair, because we needed them, they were there when we needed them, and when they need us, we're not there for them, sort of thing, so I think it's a shame.
Despite being on strikes, the crews still leave the picket lines to respond to emergency calls. But the message is, even serious calls will face substantial delays.
The strike action by NHS staff has only intensified in recent weeks, with multiple other walkouts planned for next month. Another single biggest day of action will be the beginning of March, when nurses will once again walk off the job, just like ambulance drivers are doing today.
The unions insist the solution is in the government's hands, a pay increase of about 10%. In the case of nurses, 5% above inflation, that's stubbornly in the double digits. Yet the man holding the strings to the public purse, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, says that's not affordable.
Government spend lots of money on other things, even NHS-wise, that needn't be spent, that could be paying the people that look after everybody, yeah.
February has already seen more than 500,000 people take industrial action. With public strike fatigue nowhere in sight, the walkouts are likely to continue for months. Saeed Pariza, London.
Bringing charm to the Iranian capital with some of the most beautiful Persian orchestra pieces and musical performances to jam-packed concert halls in Tehran, the most prestigious musical event in Iran is underway. The 38th Fajj International Music Festival opened in Tehran on February the 17th. While the capital is hosting over 30 music bands from across the country, foreign musicians have also found the opportunity to go on stage, including these Hungarian musicians. 7 concert halls in Tehran, as well as over 30 other arenas in 14 provinces, are hosting this year's event.
I am grateful to the musicians that took part in the festival this year. I would also like to take the opportunity to tell you that we have added some awards to our list, and other than the Barbat Prize for the Best Music Album, as of this year, we will also have the Best Song, Lyrics and Media Awards.
Over 2,000 musicians are taking part, either in the competitive Barbat Prize section or the non-competitive pop, traditional, and orchestral music sections. What has made this year's event even more special is the performance of the Iranian Police Force Music Band.
It was an honor to perform in the Fajj Music Festival, and I'm glad that military bands now also have a place in this prestigious event. I hope that more bands take part in the future.
But still, as always, the traditional and folk music sections are under the spotlight, adding glitz and glamour to the name Fajr, which means dawn in Farsi and refers to a 10-day period that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This has been the reason to hold cultural events, including a theater, a film, and a music festival, going by the same name every year. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran. The German city of Munich hosts a security conference every year to discuss global security challenges. The conference this year has been held against the backdrop of the Ukraine war. Berlin, one of Kiev's biggest arms suppliers, barred Moscow from the event. Also excluded from the list of invitees was Iran. In defiance of international norms, 3 notorious anti-Iran propagandists were invited. The 3 anti-Iran figures claim that they have achieved unity, along with several others, to campaign for international support in favor of what they call Iran's protest movement. They attended a meeting on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference on Saturday. During the meeting, Reza Pahlavi, whose family name is synonymous with decades of oppression against the Iranian nation, pleaded with Western countries to work with what he called a different Iran. He said in this case, the West would have, in his words, a true ally. How can the son of deposed Mohammad Reza Pahlavi have forgotten how Iranian people toppled his father's U.S.-backed dynasty in favor of independence and freedom? While Iranians stood up against the monarchy in Iran some 40 years ago and succeeded in overthrowing it,
Reza Pahlavi has refused to distance himself from what his father stood for. He likes being named as the son of Shah or Shahzadeh, which shows he has nothing to present rather than his infamous family background. Another anti-Iran figure who attended the meeting was Masih Alinejad, variously promoted as a journalist, activist, and dissident by Western media. Cashing in on the recent riots in Iran, she claimed that Iranians want regime change. Alinejad, who has been on U.S. government payroll for years, also urged the West to take strong action against the Islamic Republic. It's no surprise that a person funded by Washington has pinned all her hopes on Western powers. Since the riots broke out in Iran following the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini in September, Alinejad has been lobbying for support from Washington and its allies. She has tried to depict the Islamic Republic as an establishment on the decline, citing those weeks of unrest. The riots, however, have since died down and Iran has managed to restore calm. Now it seems that even hardline leaders in the West are not buying into her claims. The three anti-Iran campaigners have also asked the West to exert maximum pressure on Iran and made no secret of their request. They should be reminded that the country has managed to neutralize the effects of Western sanctions and plots. Meanwhile, Iran has been forging strong bonds with multiple countries and become a member of significant cooperation organizations. Excluding Iran from international summits seemed to be in line with desperate efforts by the West to counter the country's growing regional and international power and influence. The participation of millions of Iranians in the 44th anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution is an indicator that foreign-backed elements have failed to achieve their goals.
Another scene of wide-scale destruction in Syria, this time signed by Israel. Israeli fighter jets attacked multiple residential targets in Damascus, killing at least five people and injuring 15 others, with the majority being civilians.
All residents were sleeping in the building. This is a residential neighborhood. The missile landed here. A number of residents were killed and others injured. There are no officials or any prominent figures living here, only ordinary civilians. All apartments were heavily affected.
At 12:15 a.m., we heard loud noises. I asked my mother to step back from the windows. Suddenly, the house shook and we felt an explosion. All windows broke. We asked for help. This is a tragic reality.
The aggression caused significant damage to private property in the heavily populated Kafr Susa quarter in Damascus. Apartments, balconies, and walls collapsed, and nearby cars were affected. Syria's ancient citadel in Old Damascus was also hit. Analysts say Israel's intention for these attacks is to keep Syria in a state of instability.
For 10 years, Israel has been adopting the strategy of strategic battles between wars. The aim is to eliminate any chance of a war on Israel through weakening the enemy. Israel wants Syria to stay in a state of war and instability. This aggression in particular comes as more countries are planning to restore relations with Syria, something Israel wants to foil.
Syria's foreign ministry sent a letter to the UN saying the strikes are part of Israel's systematic aggression against civilians, urging punishment for the crimes committed by the regime. The ministry called for necessary measures to end such aggressions, as well as a clear condemnation from the United Nations Security Council. One shock after another. This is how Syrians live every day, not knowing whether they'll be waking up to an earthquake, act of aggression, or a terrorist attack. All they ask is for the international community to wake up and help ease their unprecedented plights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The Rome-based Islamic Center Imam Mahdi has recently published a book on the late Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Titled A God's Fighter, the Italian language book revolves around General Soleimani's endeavors to defend the oppressed people. A man, quote, driven by an unshakable faith in God. The book is a collection of messages, thoughts, and letters by General Soleimani, a project that has been supported by all the members of the Imam Mahdi Center.
Irki. Who did General Soleimani fight for? By publishing this book, we wanted to shed a light on a man who was always described as an anti-something. Yes, he was against Zionism, he fought against Daesh, but he did all that for God, and that's why we call him a God's fighter in our book. This project intends to fill a void in Italy, as for far too long, all accounts on General Soleimani have distorted his true image.
In 2020, 40 days after U.S. assassination of Major General Qasem Soleimani, hundreds of his posters were hung across many Italian cities. Initiatives to honor the slain Iranian military officer were held in Rome and Milan. Imam Mahdi Center's book on Soleimani also contains speeches by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani on General Soleimani's martyrdom. The publication also contains photos portraying Iran's former top military commander.
Finding good quality photos of Soleimani was a daunting task. There are only a few good shots of him around. He was not a poser. He was a humble man and he didn't love to be in the spotlight. My favorite photos are the ones depicting General Soleimani with kids and also his mother.
General Qasem Soleimani, similar to my father, because he caused that I love Islam more and more. He is my hero because he always helped the weak country or a weak Islamic country. I'm proud of him.
The book closes with 20 short stories on the life of General Soleimani, his relationship with his family, and with the late Iraqi anti-terror commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Max Civili, Rome.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of beds and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thursday, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the United States and its allies that its attempts to stir chaos in the country will not be fruitful.
I'll tell the U.S., if you create chaos in Lebanon, then you will witness chaos in the entire region. If you target our people with your conspiracies, then we will use our power and arms to make you feel pain, even if this means war against your beloved Israel.
The leader of the resistance group also said that the 2019 protests in Lebanon were merely part of a U.S. ploy, which took advantage of weaknesses in the country as part of a new strategy after the failure of direct military invasions.
Lebanon has, from the year 2019, been the target of a new U.S. plot. First, it's a plot to eradicate the achievements and the victories of the resistance and its martyrs. And second, it's a plot to take Lebanon back to being under the hegemony of the U.S., which wants to impose its conditions on the country's domestic affairs and its conditions on relations with the enemy.
Nasrallah, who addressed people during the memorial ceremony of three of Hezbollah's martyred leaders, also emphasized that supporters of the resistance group who are suffering from economic crisis will continue to support the group. Observers believe that all stalemates in Lebanon, whether the inability to elect a president or lack of economic reforms, are all the result of a wave of subtle interference by the U.S.
The U.S. is pressurizing Lebanon economically to impose its conditions and bring to power a president who is loyal to Washington and is not friendly with the resistance, so that it can implement its policies by means of soft power. Having said that, it would not seem that the U.S. has launched a war on Lebanon or the resistance. While it would seem this is an internal Lebanese affair, this is where the threat lies in their plots.
Nasrallah also touched upon the issue of offshore oil and gas exploration, saying Hezbollah will hinder Israel's production of gas from oil fields should procrastination by the companies who have contracts with Lebanon continue.
After assassination of any prominent leader of Hezbollah, the resistance would go through a landmark transformation. Now, in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In the limelight.
Wind turbines and solar panels are now generating almost enough electricity to power every home in China. The National Energy Administration said at a briefing recently, wind and solar output jumped 21% last year to 1,190 terawatt hours of electricity. That's not far off total residential power consumption of 1,340 terawatt hours, the NEA said, which was a 14% increase on the prior year as more people spent time at home. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Renew Economy reported, China's National Energy Administration has reported that the country installed a combined 125 gigawatt of new wind and solar capacity in 2022, bringing its total cumulative renewable energy capacity to over 1,200. Out of the new renewable energy capacity added was 37.6 GW of new wind energy capacity and a whopping 87.4 GW of newly installed solar power, according to Wang Dapeng, an official with the National Energy Administration, NEA, speaking during a news briefing held in Beijing recently. While the impact of new generating capacity installed during 2022 will only really be felt when looking at 2023's numbers, the NEA also reported that renewable energy account for 47.3% of China's total power generation capacity at the end of 2022, up 2.5% compared to 2021. Interestingly, as highlighted by Bloomberg News, China's wind and solar is now generating almost enough electricity to power every home in China, with renewable generation surpassing 1,190 TWh in 2022 and residential power consumption hitting 1,350 TWh, the near match is a big milestone for China. This does not include industrial power consumption, and only 17% of electricity use was classified as residential in 2020, according to the International Energy Agency, IEA. Though this will have increased during the 2 years of chaotic COVID-19 pandemic, China's industry nevertheless remains king. Also, RT had an eye on this issue, writing, China's wind and solar power generation surged last year and is now almost equal to household demand for electricity, the National Energy Administration, NEA, announced recently. However, the share of residential intake is only a fraction of overall consumption, meaning that the Asian country is still heavily reliant on fossil fuels. In 2022, wind and solar energy production soared 21% to 1,190 terawatt-hours TWh of electricity, according to NEA. Despite the surge in Chinese wind and solar power installations and generation, only 17% of electricity use in the country was classified as residential in 2020, while industry accounts for around 60% of all electricity demand, according to International Energy Agency. Beijing is ramping up the rollout of solar and wind capacity in line with its ambitious plans to produce 33% of its electricity from renewable resources by 2025 in order to reduce carbon emissions. At least 30 Chinese provinces have unveiled more renewable installation programs. In December, China launched a massive clean energy project worth more than $11 billion in its seventh largest desert in the province of Inner Mongolia. The solar and wind power base, with an overall installed capacity of 16 million kW, will be the world's largest renewable electricity generation facility of its kind in a desert area, according to the company in charge of its construction. However, some economists warn that this year the Chinese economy will expand much faster after lifting COVID restrictions, meaning that even with increased wind and solar capacity, the country will still need more fossil fuel-powered energy generation to keep its economy growing. Meanwhile, Global Times noted, construction of diverse renewable energy projects are accelerating across China with large centrally administered state-owned enterprises, major players in the rapidly growing sector stepping up activity after the Spring Festival holidays. China Huoneng Group, the country's biggest coal power generator, announced in a recent meeting that it will pivot to operating renewable energy projects with a total capacity of more than 30 million kilowatts in 2023, its investment is likely to reach 100 billion yuan, that is $14.66 billion. A total of 152 new energy projects involving 29 provinces and regions are underway or at preparatory stage. The projects cover clean energy bases in the country's north, offshore wind farm in the east, and integrated bases of hydro, power, and wind farm in the